We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are joined this week by a grandmaster, a chess journalist, an author, and a professional cricket bettor. Our guest, Jonathan Levitt, isn't as active in chess as he used to be, but he wrote or co-wrote a few great books, Genius in Chess in the 1990s, Secrets of Spectacular Chess. He also, with David Freegood, he co-wrote Bobby Fischer, The $5 Million Comeback with Grandmaster Nigel Davies, and I am Malcolm Payne. And in the past year, while he was quarantined and unable to practice his trade, he wrote a non-chess book that has been just recently been released here in the U.S. called Contemplating Comedy. It's kind of a fun meditation, a collection of jokes and one-liners, and kind of a philosophical treatise, I would say, about comedy and life in general. And I'm excited to discuss all of his work as well as his career in and out of chess. But before we welcome him, I did want to plug one event. This is a non-paid plug, but shout out to Tim Wall of the UK. Since we have a British grandmaster joining us, I did want to mention for listeners that on July 18th in Trafalgar Square in London, there will be a big chess festival, which I encourage any British listeners or anyone inclined to travel to attend. I always love those big outdoor chess festivals. There'll be lessons, blindfold chess, simo, all that stuff. And I will put the link for that in the show notes if anyone's interested in checking it out. So with that out of the way, let's welcome our guest, Grandmaster Jonathan Levitt. Jonathan, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Ben. And thank you for having me on your show. Quite an honor to appear on your show. I see you've got a fantastic back catalogue of people who have come before me. And my privilege to be here today. I should mention that the chess festival you just mentioned is open air in Trafalgar Square. And Malcolm Payne is heavily involved in the organization. And I think he's giving a blindfold simul as well on the day. So plenty of action to be had for all chess people who've watched the Queen's Gambit might want to just turn up and have a game with a grandmaster or a master, and it should be a lot of fun for everyone involved and should be COVID safe given it's open air.
Yeah, it sounds good to me. I think I've mentioned on the show before that Chess in the Schools, which is I know that Malcolm Payne's organization in London that does a scholastic outreach is involved in the chess festival, and Chess in the Schools does one in New York every year, a big outdoor blitz tournament that's just, I haven't made it in a few years, but it takes place in Central Park in the US and it's one of my favorite events. So I love that sort of thing. Jonathan, will you be attending?
Maybe. I'll see how it's going. It's a small trek from where I live in Ipswich to London. It takes a couple of hours each way. So certainly it's a possibility, but it depends if I'm feeling well and if it's a nice day and a few other factors. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same for me in New York, often a game time decision, especially with kids at home. And before we get to your career, Tim Wall mentioned that you're good friends with Malcolm Payne. You guys go way back.
Yeah, we jointly wrote a book, as you mentioned, the Bobby Fischer $5 million comeback book. I've known Malcolm for what must be 45 years or more now, so I'm 58 and I knew him as a child, so yeah, we lived in close to each other in North London at the time, and he's been instrumental in building up the British chess scene over the years, and is one of our main organizers and journalists, and is a strong player as well, of course.
Yeah, impressive. And owns the chess, I'm going to forget the name of the shop, but the chess shop in London as well, yeah, right?
The Chess and Bridge Shop, I think it's called. Of course, the school's project that he's been working on for the last few years is really quite an enormous thing and is helping to spread the game, nationally and internationally. So it's a fantastic thing that he's doing there. But anyway, enough about him. What about me?
Well, not quite enough about him, because I have to say I'm impressed with the blindfold simul. So well into his 50s, he's able to do a blindfold simul. Do you think you could pull? I know you're not as active as you used to be, Jonathan, but do you think you could pull something like that off?
I've played a blindfold simul before when I was at school, when I was about 15. So I could probably do it. I wouldn't like to try, though, at this stage in life. It would be taxing and demanding, and I'm not quite sure the benefits would justify the effort. By the way, I got an email from Tim Wall, which mentioned that blindfold chess, where Malcolm Payne will take on people blindfolded. I think we're just assuming that Malcolm will be blindfolded rather than the people he's taking on. But
right, yeah, that would be my, speaking of comedy and chess, yeah, that would be my kind of blindfold simul. That's very funny. And, you know, hearing you talk about giving blindfold simuls, which I think listeners will know, but basically just means you're playing a bunch of people and you're not even looking at the board. And more traditionally, when we're not joking, the participants are looking at the board. So not only are you playing many people at once, which is a handicap, but you're picturing multiple boards, which is obviously a huge handicap. And for listeners newer to chess, I definitely recommend you Google Timur Gureyev. He was on the podcast talking about his breaking of the world record of playing the most people simultaneously blindfolded, just staggering feats. And actually, Jerry Wells and I did a book recap of the book called Blindfold Chess. So if you want to dig into that subculture, there's lots to do there. But let's leave that there for now, because what I wanted to begin with speaking about with you, Jonathan, is your book Genius in Chess, which I would say is tangentially related, because it touches on sort of what constitutes chess talent. And you have this famous thing in there called the Levitt equation, which we'll get to. But why don't we begin, Jonathan, by if you could just discuss a little bit what piqued your interest in this topic of chess talent?
Well, it's, plenty of chess players write about chess openings and endgames and their games. And my books on chess, my two main books on chess have been about other things. In Secrets of Spectacular Chess, I look at the question of aesthetics. And in Genius in Chess, I look at the question of talent. And the inner workings of the chess playing brain. I've always been interested in psychology, and although I've not studied it officially, I've certainly read quite a bit about it. There wasn't such a book on the market, and I wanted to explore that subject. And I tried to do it in a light and kind of fun way. There's a kind of essay at the start of the book about various questions relating to chess talent and what it is, how you define it, what is genius, what is ability, what is, you know, how to define all of these terms, originality, creativity, all of that. And then the second half of the book kind of deals with an array of tests where readers can try and gorge their own ability by seeing how they do compared to other people on puzzles and questions, which, I mean, the idea is that they don't involve knowledge of chess, but they just try to test your raw talent. Whether that is actually possible is another question. And to some extent, it succeeds, I think, and the book can give readers a good idea about how talented they are, but of course it's not a proven science. You mentioned the Levitt equation. That is a bit of fun, really. It's a light a light-hearted equation. The equation states that your chess rating will be less than essentially 10 times your IQ plus 1,000. Your rating in ELO points, that is. So for example, if your IQ is 100 and you're of average intelligence, it's saying that your chess rating will be less than 2,000. If your IQ is 180 and you're a sort of world-class genius, it's saying your chess rating will be under 2,800. It obviously depends on how much you study the game, and that's why there's a less than symbol rather than an equals. It's the kind of limit of how far you can go based on how smart you are. But as I say, it's very lighthearted. It's just put there as a bit of fun. To what extent it captures anything, I don't really know. It's not scientifically analyzed or tested, but it's plausible. I mean, I think it is true that the people that reach 2,800 are geniuses, with an IQ of that kind of level, 180 odd, and an average person probably would struggle to get to more to master level. I think you have to be fairly bright to get to master level. So I don't know. I mean, I'll let others judge. I don't want to take it too seriously, though. I mean, it's obviously a little bit controversial. Anything to do with IQ is controversial, and it was put out there when I wrote the book in the 1990s as a bit of fun. And it obviously stimulated a bit of controversy even then, even before the age of Twitter and Facebook and all of that.
Yeah, I've been cringing a little bit just hearing you discuss it, because I can almost see the mob with the pitchfork forming. But
yeah, exactly, Ben.
but yeah, so we should say it's lighthearted. Don't sue Jonathan or flame him. We should also say that, of course, I've interviewed cognitive scientists like Dr. Christopher Chabri and Vishnu Srikumar, and they've both said that the current data suggests that there is a correlation between IQ and chess ability. It's I believe Christopher Chabri said it's a mild but persistent correlation. So Jonathan's not speaking totally out of left field, but it's all in good fun. So I have to ask Jonathan, hearing you discuss this, like, what was your most sort of memorable backlash from having written this hot take?
It wasn't too bad. I mean, as I say, it was fortunate it was written before the age of Twitter and Facebook, so I didn't get flamed or anything like that. But obviously a lot of people thought it was nonsense. A lot of people feel uncomfortable discussing IQ in any way whatsoever. There wasn't any serious backlash from it, other than, you know, just some people having a go at me on occasion about it. But I'm tough enough, old enough, and ugly enough not to be too bothered by any of that.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear it wasn't too serious. And of course, the main thing that IQ measures is your ability to take an IQ test. And the main thing that chess measures is your ability to compete in this game. So, you know, performing in both of them well, to me, doesn't surprise me, you know, irrespective of like any grander implications for what it means about like your life skills or, you know, your human potential. It's not surprising that someone who can do well on a test like that, measuring or attempting to measure sort of cognitive processing, would also do well in a game that in a way measures cognitive processing. But Jonathan, whether fortunately or unfortunately, we're going to go a little deeper on this topic because we've got a question from a Patreon supporter of the podcast, Evan Rosenberg, who I've known for a long time. So thank you for the support, Evan. And Evan writes in and asks, he says, since the publication of Genius in Chess, the idea of quantifiable measurements of intelligence like the IQ has been expanded on by the introduction of more qualitative measures like Gardner's multiple intelligences. For instance, so number one, have you considered replacing the IQ in the Levitt equation with any other numerical composite that would represent some other measurable form of intelligence? And there's like three questions here. Should I keep going, Jonathan?
Let's deal with them one by one. I haven't. The answer to that is I haven't. As I said, it was just a bit of fun. I think Evan's question is intelligent and well thought out. It's very true that intelligence is just a single, in IQ terms, is just a single number, whereas intelligence is multifaceted. There are many aspects to it. And it's fairly clear to me that chess talent picks on certain aspects of intelligence, but not all of them. And I think there will be correlations between chess ability and certain things within intelligence, but perhaps which will be stronger than the correlations between chess ability and other aspects of intelligence. So, for example, spatial reasoning and logic will be well correlated with chess ability, I suspect, but other things might not be, like emotional intelligence or other forms of I haven't really been following the psychology too closely since I wrote the book. I did read up about quite a lot of this stuff 25 years ago, but I've not stayed in touch with it. So I'm not going to talk too much about it because I'm not in a position to do so. But in general, I would say that chess is fairly strongly correlated with certain aspects of intelligence, but not others.
Yeah, makes sense. And just to complete Evan's question, although I understand your hesitance, this is a book you wrote a long time ago. Chess is not even your career these days, and we're not cognitive scientists to begin with. But you know, as I mentioned to you offline, I only picked up Genius in Chess in the past week or two, and I've enjoyed it. But I've seen the Levitt equation come up in sort of the chess conversation over the years. So I know it did make a bit of an imprint. So anyway, to finish up Evan's question, he asks, would you want to subject the Levitt equation to cultural scrutiny, like the argument that IQs are biased or the new pool of unrated chess players without any formal tournament experience, who have achieved impressive online ratings?
I guess the answer is simply no.
Yeah.
It's a bit of fun.
Yeah, exactly. And as I've mentioned many times on the show, I do think that what Evan alludes to, all these new entrants into the chess world, particularly adult chess players, and the increased ability to measure sort of improvement with both the online ratings and, of course, with puzzle ratings and obviously with good old regular OTB ratings, there's a lot of fertile ground for research. Again, as Dr. Vishnu Srikumar and Dr. Christopher Chabri both said, it's really a matter of someone more qualified than us, finding the funding or the energy or both to sort of answer these questions about what kind of improvement is possible and what correlates with chess skill and all that stuff. But hopefully we're in early days of figuring this out. But I did, Jonathan, so we'll leave it there with the straight up intelligence conversations, IQ conversations, I should say. But I did want to hear the story that you told in Genius in Chess, because you opened the book discussing Grandmaster Alexei Shirov, of course, legendary player, was perennial top five player in the 1990s into the early 2000s, wrote a classic book called Fire on Board, a famous swashbuckling attacking style. And he stayed at your house and you got a chance to analyze with him. And you talk in the book about sort of you're trying to gauge the difference between you, a 2400-2500 grandmaster, and he, a world-class grandmaster. Could you share a little bit about those experiences, Jonathan?
Yeah, I also went to stay with him in Spain, a place called Tarragona, on the beach.
Sounds great.
for a week. And it's just as well I took my chess set, because he didn't have one. He kind of walked around analyzing positions blindfold all the time and occasionally used his computer. He was on a different planet to me in terms of ability. I mean, he just could do things in his head that I simply couldn't do. In Genius in Chess, I talk about, you know, some differences that might make up the 200 point rating difference between us. And I think I talk about 50 points of it being maybe opening knowledge, 50 points being end game knowledge, 50 points being general fitness, and 50 points being better sporting motivation or whatever. But I think more than that is the talent differential. I think my final conclusion on the subject was that no matter how hard I worked at chess, I was never going to be as good as him, nor others who were better than him, like Kasparov. That you just cannot compete if the brain is so different. I mean, I've spent time with Kasparov as well many years ago, and his brain works in a different way to most people's. I mean, he just remembers everything. He just knows lots of information and seems to just recall it instantly. And we've seen perhaps recently Magnus Carlsen recalling various game, being shown game snippets and recalling exactly the game it was played. It was from 1994 and in the game Anand versus Timon or whatever. And he just remembers everything. And my brain just doesn't work like that. I think my memory capacity is way lower. I've not got a bad memory. I'm probably above average slightly with things like memory, but I'm not outstanding. And I think to be the world champion or to be 2700 plus or to be kind of up there with these guys, you do have to have a particularly well-functioning brain. It may be something to do with synaptic connections. It may be, I don't know what it is, but just like some people are taller than others, I think some people have better brain functioning than others. And it's not really a fair competition between an average person and somebody like Garry Kasparov. And I don't think an average person, however hard they work, however long they try, is ever going to be on the same level as Kasparov. It's just not humanly possible for an average person to do that. You've got to be exceptional to be at that level in chess. And I'm not saying anything surprising here. I think it's intuitively obvious to most people, but it becomes very clear when you get to know these people that they are very different to normal people. They are, of course, hardworking at chess, and they put a lot of effort in, and over an extended and long period. But it's more than that. It's the combination of hard work, determination, motivation, persistent motivation for years and years, plus outstanding natural ability. Without all of those factors, you just don't hit the top. And if I look back on my career as a player, I mean, I was fairly talented. I you know, I, I'm I was capable enough to reach Grandmaster level, but I didn't have the tool bag, the equipment in my tool bag to get to 2800. There was no way I could have done that. I just don't think it was possible. I could have worked harder. I could have been a little stronger than I was. I could have been more efficient. I could have been more motivated. I certainly could have been fitter and healthier and had more energy if I'd trained in those in that way. There are all sorts of ways I could have been a bit better, but I don't think I could have been 200 points better than I was. I just don't think it was possible. So I'm not, I have no regrets. I mean, you know, being involved in chess is a worthy thing to be, even if you're not number one. Even if you scrape into the top 1,000 or the top 100, which perhaps I did at one point in the peak of my career, I feel I made some contributions to chess, but it wasn't as an out and out champion player. I was just a talented, quite good player. But you know, I think the books I wrote, the teaching I did, some of the problems I composed were all contributions to chess, as well as some of the games I played. So I feel, you know, I spent many years in the chess world and I feel I made some contribution to it. But obviously, as a player, it was very minor compared to some of the great people we're discussing, like Kasparov, Carlsen, Shirov, and various others. They're the real giants and geniuses of chess. I was just a bit player.
Yeah. Well, again, everything is relative. You know, there's only 1,600 grandmasters or whatever it is. So anyone listening probably feels the same way about you. And of course, this is a topic that's come up a lot on the podcast. I'll never forget Grandmaster Patrick Wolf when he was talking about working on Vishyanin's team, just talking similarly about how he very quickly realized he was in the presence of a god. It was just a totally different scenario than his, you know, top in the US level chess talent. But I do want to, Jonathan, I want to get more into your chess background, what you did do to get to the impressive level that you attained. But first, I want to take a break and hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by aimchess.com. If you haven't checked out aimchess.com by now, what are you waiting for? What aimchess does is it collects your games from the major chess sites and then gives you actionable advice of how to improve your game. It might be to work on a specific opening or to get better at end games or improve your time management or whatever it may be. And then it gives you related puzzles to help you improve that specific skill. They are constantly improving the site. They recently added blindfold tactics, time management training, common checkmate patterns. So there's so much to do there. If you decide to subscribe, be sure to use the promo code PERPETUAL30. Details are in the show notes for aimchess.com.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we are back. And Jonathan, I did do a bit of digging into your career. So I already know that you learned chess at the age of 8 and then really started playing at the age of 13. You've done a couple interviews. Shout out to the Chess Pit podcast. And you did one on chessbase.com discussing your background. But one thing I didn't hear you talk about that much was just how you got good at chess, which is kind of what everyone wants to know. So once you did start playing at 13, were you like a book person? Were you like a playing all the time person? What contributed to your ascension up the chess ranks, do you think?
Okay, I was fairly serious about chess. I did read books every school holidays. I had a plan of reading two or three chess books And I combined that with a fair amount of playing, the weekenders and what was available to a junior in London at the time. So a combination of playing quite a lot, taking it fairly seriously, reading and being fairly determined. I mean, I started at 13. I would say it was, a balanced mixture of reading and playing that got me better. I do remember as I pushed forward, I did start to take notes on my games and I kind of treated my thinking as a kind of work in progress, and I wanted to get it right, and I wanted to improve it, and I wanted to learn skills and, of course, identify where things went wrong when they did go wrong. I was very self-critical. I think one of the earliest books I read was by Botvinnik, and that may have had an influence on me because he's fairly serious and heavy-minded, if you like. You know, you've got to take chess as a serious business, and it's important. And I guess I imbibed some of that at an unnaturally young age of maybe 14, 15, and it influenced the way I approached the game. And yeah, I was quite studious. It's difficult to recall exactly what made me jump up the ranks. I remember going from maybe 14, 1500 strength when I was about 13 to 2000 strength within a year, and maybe 2200 strength within 3 years. And by the time I was 17 or 18, I was pushing on master strength. Probably got my actual title when I was about 20. By which time I was at university. So a relatively late start compared to some of the juniors these days. Definitely a combination of studying, taking the game seriously, being fairly determined, and being... Okay, I did other things as well. I became a math student at a university. But when I finished that, I did turn chess professional, and it took me a while to actually get the Grandmaster title to make that final jump up to about 2500 strength. All of that time I was fairly focused on my game. I mean, I think from a relatively early age, in my late 20s anyway, I did start doing a lot of teaching juniors, and I taught in a school. And I have a feeling that probably doesn't help you develop as a player. I think it's a very separate activity to playing. I mean, the teaching mindset is one where you're trying to help others improve and you're trying to give to other people. And the playing mindset is the complete opposite. You're trying to be a real bastard, basically, and stop your opponent doing anything and drown out his prospects and slowly finish him off. It's not a giving mindset. It's a taking mindset and a kind of preventing mindset and a mindset where what's good for your opponent is bad for you, and what's bad for your opponent is good for you. And that playing mindset is so opposite to the teaching mindset that I suspect alternating between the two probably just gets you a bit confused. So if you want to be a player, possibly best not to mix it with too much teaching. Although it's easier said than done, because at the level I was at, which was kind of average-ish grandmaster strength, it was difficult to make a living just as a player, and teaching brought in a better income per hour than playing, and indeed than writing. So it was a kind of necessary part of making a living that I had to do the teaching, and maybe, as I say, it prevented me from reaching a slightly higher level that I might have reached if I hadn't been teaching, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's the constant dilemma for chess professionals, although these days at least you have a few more options in terms of like streaming and stuff like that, although, you know, that stuff's probably not great for your chess either, unless you're streaming studying chess, which I know some people manage to pull off. So it sounds like you were fairly self-motivated, because you are studying chess hard, achieved a lot, and you studied math at one of the Oxford colleges. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was Magdalen College, Oxford. I didn't really have a teacher as such at chess. My teachers were my opponents when I played them, and the authors of the books that I read. I never formally got taught. I don't know if that makes a big difference. Possibly having a good teacher early on can set you on a more efficient path to improvement and get you doing the right sorts of things and developing the right sort of habits earlier. And if you self-teach, if you're self-taught rather, and you learn it all yourself, you might not do it by the most efficient path. So I would recommend parents of promising juniors to get themselves a decent teacher. I think that is an efficiency worth having and definitely worth the money, even if a grandmaster charges $60 plus an hour or whatever they might charge, or $100 an hour, whatever they might charge these days. It's probably worth having the odd hour or 1 hour once a month or something to have a strategy to the way you improve your game, to read the right books, to approach things in the right way. You don't want the grandmaster spoon feeding the junior or improver. Of course, adults can improve too. It doesn't have to be a junior. You don't need to be spoon fed, but I think some general strategic guidance is probably worthwhile from a teacher.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And of course, these days, again, there's also all the online tools for players to consume, as recent guest Braden Lachlan discussed. So many good YouTube videos that can sort of function as a teaching addition, although they can't go over your games the way that a teacher can and explain positional concepts. Speaking of which, Jonathan, so you mentioned Botvinnik's book. Were any other chess books particularly formative for you?
I remember being quite impressed by Lasker's Manual of Chess. I thought Lasker was very clear thinking about the game. Fischer's 60 Memorable Games, obviously, was something that came across my desk.
The classics, yeah.
As it probably did for most people of my generation. I read quite widely. Books by John Nunn, and I developed an interest in endgame studies and the art of chess quite early, I suppose. So I've always, looked at those kind of things from an early age, or teenage years anyway, onwards. So yeah, I probably...
Yeah, you...
Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, you and David Fried could write at length in Secrets of Spectacular Chess about your affinity for endgame studies and sort of break down the different components of what can make an endgame study pleasing or unique. Endgame study, of course, being a composed position with one discrete solution. So a great calculation method, as well as a way to sort of just appreciate the beauty of chess, as Tim Krabbe discussed when he discussed the Babson task on this podcast. So it's a huge rabbit hole that one can go down if one wants, but also just a great training tool. So what piqued your interest in endgame studies, and how much of your chess success do you attribute to sort of being interested in that that sideline of chess early?
Oh, it's a tricky question. I found them very beautiful, and they just appealed to me, so I naturally gravitated towards them. I think it's more to do with the way my mind works. I'm more of a mathematician than a linguist, so I kind of analyze logically quite well, but my ability to kind of absorb broad information is probably no more than average, but my ability to analyze logically is pretty good. So endgame studies kind of fit in with that. They're deep and they're analytical, and they're it's a single line of thought which has to go quite a long way. So I kind of naturally gravitated towards it because of the way my mind works, I think. To what extent it made me a better player? Probably, to be honest with you, not. It probably didn't make that significant a contribution to my chess. I think it helps a little bit with analysis and the ability to kind of think clearly and analyze the endgame, but it's only a small part of chess. There are so many other parts of chess, like opening knowledge, positional ideas, general decision making in unclear situations where you can't just be logical and get everything sorted in the same way that you can with an endgame study. But you know, it's not all about, it isn't all about just how good you get at chess. I mean, chess is more than that. I mean, there's an art to the game, there's a history to the game, there's a culture to the game. Whether you're a 1600 player or 1700 player or 2400 player, it's not everything. I mean, it's also about how much you enjoy chess, what you get out of it, whether it helps your brain think, whether it gives you good feedback. There's so many benefits you can get from chess, which are independent really of how strong you are. I mean, being a competitor and being really motivated to score points is one thing, and being able to appreciate watching games of chess or chess problems or studies is another thing. And in the book Secrets of Spectacular Chess, me and David Friedgood develop a theory and outline our theory of chess aesthetics, which basically looks at four elements: depth, paradox, flow, and geometry. And we try to analyze the beauty of practical chess and the beauty of problems and the beauty of studies in terms of those four elements. And I think, the book's been well received. We probably did a pretty good job. And I think it's one of my major contributions to chess was jointly writing that book with David Friedgood. And it's full of beautiful positions, really lovely, fascinating little studies and problems. And I think anybody with a love for chess will really enjoy that book if they get hold of it and want to look at the positions in there. I've tried to make it fun to read and a bit more lively than just a dry account of some chess positions. It's got a bit of text to it and a bit of a few stories in it, and I think it's a good piece of work. It's probably my main contribution to chess, if truth be told, was writing that book. Genius in Chess was a lesser book. I think Secrets of Spectacular is probably a more significant work.
Yeah, it's a great book. I know it's been recommended a few times on the podcast, and I enjoy it as well. Again, should mention for listeners, I think what you said about, chess improvement not being the be-all, end-all, is important, but also should warn that if you do pick up Secrets of Spectacular Chess, if you're rated below 1800, don't expect to get a lot of the puzzles right. They're extremely challenging, but as Jonathan says, he deconstructs what makes this puzzle unique, what makes it appealing, what gives you that sort of aha feeling when you get it. So it's something certainly that all chess players with some work can appreciate it. So definitely, I agree. It's a great contribution to chess. So you mentioned you have a mathematician's mind, Jonathan, and obviously you studied math in college, and we'll get to your current career in time. But I'm curious, I know you pursued chess and taught chess out of university. Did you ever take a proper job? Did you ever work out of chess and out of betting?
Not really. I've never really been employed as such. I've always been self-employed, except for a few months, maybe almost a year, when I worked for Kasparov Chess. It was a startup company, and I was working as a writer and a journalist, essentially. And my boss was Mig Greengard, my immediate boss. He was the one that was telling me what to do. And his boss was Kasparov. And So that was the chain of command. I traveled around reporting on certain tournaments. I reported on the Kasparov-Kramnik match in London, and was liaising with the Kramnik camp, in fact, to get their feedback on the games after they were played. I did various writing things. It was an interesting year, but it's the only year I've ever actually been paid a wage as such.
That's impressive.
Never had a job. I'm 58 now, and I've never really been paid a wage as such, but made my living one way or another in chess until I was about 40, and betting on cricket essentially in the last 2 decades.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan, I want to hear the story of how you got into betting on cricket, and then of course to discuss your newest book. But first, let's take one more break to hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is proud to be brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Chessable, of course, is known for its proprietary move trainer technology, which utilizes spaced repetition to quiz you and make sure that you remember whatever tactical patterns or opening sequences that you're working on. They have a huge catalog of great books from top flight authors, both for purchase. And if you check for their short and sweet courses, you can find tons of free content. Speaking of free content, Chessable, of course, has also recently launched an adult improvement focused chess podcast called How to Chess, with yours truly hosting it. Check for it on Chessable's YouTube channel, and you can also subscribe on the podcast platforms.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we are back. So, Jonathan, I'm going to ask you the same question that people used to ask me many years ago, which is, how does one become a professional gambler?
I kind of drifted into it. When I was 40, I got this medical problem called scleroderma, which... It had a fairly sudden onset, and my energy was vastly reduced suddenly. It came back a bit after that, but initially it was a little bit scary. Anyway, it was fairly clear from what the doctors were saying that traveling around playing chess tournaments was going to be too challenging to continue doing, and I needed to find some other way of making a living. And I just was aware that people would doing something called arbitrage, which is essentially placing two bets on opposite outcomes in such a way that you make a small profit whichever outcome occurs. And I was at home. I've always had an interest in cricket since my grandfather taught me the joys of the game when I was a small child. I just noticed that these so-called arbitrages popped up from time to time while you watch cricket and while you were looking at the odds at the bookies. And surprisingly often you had the opportunity to make a small amount by, as I say, spotting some some strange situations in the betting market where these opportunities had popped up. So having noticed this, I kind of spent a little while looking into it further and started betting, and I found I was able to actually make a little bit. At first it was very slow, but I then developed other methods as well as arbitrage and started to sort of understand ways of analyzing cricket situations. In some ways, looking at it like a chess player would, analyzing ahead, imagining what was likely to happen in the next few overs and how the game might develop, and picking up on critical turning moments in the game where the kind of the odds were out of kilter with the reality of what dynamically was likely to happen in the immediate future. And I kind of developed a few methods, and the pattern recognizing chess brain maybe helped me do that. I'm not sure exactly, but within a year or two, I was actually making a reasonable living at it. And within 5 years, I was making a very good living at it. So yeah, much better than the living I was making in chess, to be honest. And I've been doing it consistently for the last 15 years, doing pretty well. It's not luck, obviously, not when I've done it for so long and it's been so consistent. It's got to be some kind of skill. But I don't know. It's not something for everyone. It will appeal to some people doing what I do, and it won't appeal to others. It suits me is all I can say. I'm happy doing it. I enjoy it. I find it a little bit of, I find it quite calming work. It's quite suits my mentality. I'm not a risk taker. I may be a professional gambler, but I hate being exposed to risk, and probably that's what makes me quite good at it. What about you, Ben? What was your gambling, stock market related or some other form?
Well, I've been there and done that. I didn't have success in that endeavor, but I was a professional poker player, as a lot of chess players have been and are for 7 years, and definitely some similarities. But you know, I know a lot of people who bet sports for fun, and I know some people who bet sports for profit, and it certainly strikes me as harder to make a go of it than poker was when I was doing it, especially. As you've alluded to in interviews, given that these sports books don't like it when you win,
which <No. laughs>
can make it a challenge. And I, you know, I don't want to side. A lot of our listeners are not gamblers, so even though it's of personal interest to me, I don't feel like we should go too deep on this topic. But I did just want to briefly touch on that I enjoyed, or I don't know if enjoyed is the right word, but I appreciated your sort of little defense of gambling in contemplating comedy. I know that obviously it gambling ruins people's lives. I don't want to. That shouldn't be sugarcoated by any means, but I think of it as another vice that people can either learn to keep at arm's length or possibly derive a career from in rare circumstances like your own. I don't know if you would want to touch on that briefly, because I know in the past, like when I was interviewing Lawrence Trent, he was obviously Lawrence also has been known to place a bet or two, and he was kind of openly looking for people to bet with him. And I know that for people that without a gambling background, that sounds strange. So I just did want to briefly kind of touch on the fact that some people have that background and have that predilection, but that certainly doesn't mean that I think everyone should be running out to gamble or anything like that.
Yeah, we don't want to corrupt your audience. I appreciate that there are young juniors and their families watching, and gambling does have a bad reputation. As you say, it does ruin some people's lives. But then again, I mean, I compare it in the book in Contemplating Comedy a little bit with drinking and alcohol. I mean, alcohol ruins quite a few people's lives too. But on the other hand, there is a plus side. There's an industry that creates jobs. There are many hundreds of millions of people who enjoy the pleasures of a quiet drink from time to time, and there's nothing wrong with that. And I think similarly with betting, the fact that it ruins some people's lives, a minority, is not to be sniffed at, and it's true and it's serious. But there is also a plus side. It adds spice to a lot of people's lives. They enjoy watching sport with a little bit of money riding on it, and I don't think there's anything majorly wrong with that. You can't ban these things on the basis that a small minority go astray and ruin their lives with it. I mean, you can't ban alcohol totally. You shouldn't ban gambling totally. You shouldn't ban the telephone because you get crank callers. I mean, that is the approach taken by, say, some countries, but it's not an approach that I think should be taken. I think you've got to be brave enough to have freedoms and to deal with the downsides of those freedoms, and try and benefit from the upsides of them. State-imposed rules. I mean, I think sometimes they're necessary, probably with this COVID disaster, it was necessary to have some lockdowns and to stop people being free. It wasn't after all an individual wasn't just being free with himself. It was having an effect on others if he spread the disease. And I understand the motivation for clamping down on freedoms in that situation. And I think it was well motivated, and I think it was correct to have lockdowns. But with things like gambling and drinking and possibly even with drugs, I think that freedom should be the default position where you allow people to do things and try to manage the consequences in such a way that the downsides are limited and the upsides are enjoyed. But that's my personal opinion.
Yeah, and I tend to agree. And of course, the method you describe of sort of arbitraging different line prices is the exact thing that goes on in financial markets. In fact, back in the day when I interviewed Grandmaster Pascal Charbonneau, who turned his chess abilities into a job in finance, he worked in arbitrage. So there are both sort of more accepted methods of arbitraging and the dark arts that you practice. But in any event, did just want to touch on that. But let's get to your book. So Contemplating Comedy, I really enjoyed it. There's a lot of, it's a very sort of wide-ranging book, although predominantly about comedy. And I thought it might be fun, Jonathan, if you read a little passage from it. Now, we should say it's not a chess book, but as when any chess player picks up a pen, it chess tends to make its way into the work. So are you ready to read a small passage, Jonathan?
Sure, I'll give it a try. My voice isn't brilliant, but I'll try. As you say, it's definitely not a book about chess, but there are maybe three or four pages in the book which relate to the game. Mainly I'm talking about how chess influenced my development at one point in the book. Since you have a chess audience predominantly with this podcast, I'll pick something from the book which is about chess. Let me see. In this chapter, I'm talking about the various influences people have as their brains develop, and the kind of memes and patterns that influence us. And I'm talking about how chess influenced me as an example of that. And okay, so reading from the book now. Chess has taught me to have a forward-looking mindset, to try to look ahead where you can. It is almost always better to be expecting something than just to do things without any idea of what might happen next. It has taught me a lot about the limitations of my own thinking. You cannot get good at chess without being critical about your thinking. Learning from mistakes does not happen unless you're brutally honest with yourself about where things have gone wrong with your whole thinking process. Chess also teaches you to try to achieve balance and harmony when making decisions under pressure. Years of tournament chess will make you psychologically tough too. You need to get good at thinking calmly and clearly under duress. On another level, you can also learn to appreciate the beauty of chess ideas, which, like, say, music, poetry, or art, can be a lifetime source of pleasure. I then go on a little bit and start to give one or two jokes about chess. I'll just quote one of them. There aren't too many good jokes about chess, unfortunately. But
yeah, we'll get to that.
There's one by Milton Jones. I got arrested for playing chess in the street. I said, it's because I'm black, isn't it? That's quite a good one.
Yeah, it is. And what you say in the book about chess teaching you, that sort of dovetails to our prior conversation about the fact that you've never had a real job. There aren't a lot of games you can study in your teens that can sort of set that path for someone. But chess teaching the like you say, the ability to be critical of oneself is something that, if you can apply that across fields, that it can, you know, you can advance in other fields as well. So certainly appreciate that point. But I want to talk about sort of the the idea of comedy in chess. And I had a couple questions that as I batted this around. Number one is, do you think that chess players are funnier, less funny, or the same amount of funny as sort of the general populace in your experience, Jonathan?
Funnier, definitely. No hesitation saying
intentionally funnier.
Yes. One of the things I've missed about giving up professional chess is the company of chess players. I still interact with some chess players from time to time, of course, but not as much as before. And they're different to the general public. They're sharper. They're quite intense. I think they're quick. They're very quick-witted, generally. And they're in your face as well, chess players. They're quite aggressive. And I kind of like that. It's as I say, I miss it, and definitely chess players are, I think, funnier than the average non-chess playing population. I mean, I've known a lot of funny people in the chess world. It's difficult to single out names, but I mean, nearly all the grandmasters and strong players and masters and lesser players too. They generally tend to be quite witty and fun. I mean, somebody like Tony Miles, I remember being very, very funny in private. I mean, he was a very witty guy. Somebody like Nigel Davies is a funny. I don't know if you follow him on Twitter or Facebook.
Yes, I do. Yeah,
he's very funny sometimes. And Nigel Short can be very funny. You know, as I say, nearly all of them can be quite funny when they want to be, and but those three stand out in the English chess world. I mean, I remember coming across some Americans who were quite funny too. Yasser Sarawan was a great raconteur back in the 1990s. He used to tell long stories and sort of, he was very charming, very witty, good company. I haven't seen him or spoken to him for ages, but I remember some of the jokes he told me from 30 years back. So, yeah, he was. I think he's a natural choice for a good commentator on chess. He's quite charming.
Yeah, especially with all the stories he has And I personally got to give a shout out to two friends of the podcast, Ben Feingold, who I thought of when you described as people being sort of in your face with their humor. Ben Feingold goes for a high volume approach, but I'd say a decent percentage, a good enough percentage of his jokes land. And then I got to shout out my funniest German in the world, Jan Gustafsson. So many funny chess players. And again, you've touched on this story in your interviews with Chessbase and the Chess Pit, but could you? I know that this contemplating comedy was a project born by the quarantine, basically, born by your not being able to bet on live cricket without live cricket happening. But how long had these sort of questions about the nature of comedy and what makes a joke funny, how long had these questions been rattling around in your head? And like, when did you know that this was going to be a book?
Yeah, difficult question to answer. I don't know precisely. I know that when quarantine happened, it was quite sudden. I was working on the Pakistan 2020 cricket competition, and I was doing games every day, and it just suddenly stopped because of COVID in midway. And suddenly, all around the world, there was absolutely no cricket for months on end. And so I didn't have my usual activity to keep me busy, and it took me a few weeks before I settled down into writing a book. But once I made that decision and once I got started, it came out pretty quickly. It was there waiting to come out, I guess. Over the last decade or so, I'd been taking a few notes and jotting down a few funny lines and a few other thoughts that I thought were interesting, either funny or interesting. And I didn't know the structure of the book when I first started it, and it kind of evolved as I wrote it. But it, as I say, it was there wanting to come out. I had plenty of ideas to. I didn't find it difficult to sort of come up with stuff to write about. So it must have been. I'd had the idea of obviously writing a book some years back, but never really got to it. I never had the time to focus on it until COVID struck. What the motivation was behind it, I'm not entirely sure. Maybe in the back of my mind, I was writing this book for my son. Maybe, I'm not sure. It's all too subconscious. I don't really have access to the inner workings of my own brain even. So, I mean, I hadn't really brought up my son. He'd been brought up by his mother, and we'd separated when Nicholas was two. And perhaps the book is some kind of subconscious way of communicating something to him that I'd kind of not been able to do as a father in a normal way. Perhaps that's part of the subconscious motivation behind the book, but I definitely wanted to write, and yeah, I'm glad I did. I think I've produced something that was worthwhile there, and it wouldn't have happened without COVID. So to that small extent, I'm grateful for the break from my normal betting activities and that I've managed to produce something with it with that time. But it's for others to judge how good it is. I mean, it hasn't sold in large numbers yet, but then hasn't been out that long, and I haven't really done any marketing or paid for any adverts or anything. So at the moment, it's just kind of making its way around the chess world a little slowly. And hopefully it will go beyond that in due course. Once it gets properly published in America, that will help. I'll start maybe doing a bit more advertising and try to promote the book with a bit more energy and gusto than I have so far. So far, I've just done a little bit on Facebook and Twitter amongst people that I already know. And that's probably not enough to sell it in its thousands. It's been a few hundred so far.
Yeah, well, like you say, the launch, I think, in the US will help. Is there a timeline on that, Jonathan?
There's a chap who's trying to get it sorted. I'm hoping it'll be within a couple of months. I mean, it's available now in the US as a hard copy. It's just you might have to wait 3 or 4 days for the post, and you might be charged about $3 or $4 more. Because it's probably finding its way from England one way or another before you get it. Whereas in a couple of months' time, hopefully it'll be printed in the USA and available slightly cheaper and quicker. But I think you can get it for under $20 already on Amazon in the UK, in the US. So it's not unavailable. And of course, you can read it on Kindle from anywhere in the world.
Already. Yeah, I was gonna ask about that. People, myself included, love their Kindles. So. Cool. Well, it's been a pleasure, Jonathan. But before we let you go, do you have any? I know you've had so many brushes with top players, as you've alluded to in your writing and in this conversation. But do you have any favorite stories that the chess world should hear about your encounters with your fellow grandmasters?
Nothing that really springs to mind in terms of sort of outright funny or really memorable. I mean, obviously, I found it fascinating dealing with Kasparov when I did. I played him in a simul as a child. I mean, he's about the same age as me. I was about 18 and he was maybe a few months older. And that was a draw. I seem to remember he was dealing with 12 top English juniors, and this was just before I think he was playing Korshnoi or something at the time. And then I played him an exhibition game when he'd just finished off Nigel Short in the World Championship. I was one of the commentators at that match, and he played me an exhibition game where he beat me fairly easily, unfortunately. And after that, I had further dealings with him when I wrote a website promoting his great predecessor's books. He used to phone me fairly regularly with kind of some analysis that he wanted put up on the website. And we discussed the way that website was going. And he phoned me every week for a few months, which was very interesting. I mean, just getting an insight into the way his brain worked, which, as I say, is very different from normal people. I mean, I wouldn't describe him as a particularly nice person. You know, he had his own charm, and he was certainly very memorable to deal with.
He sounds like you're being diplomatic. Would you describe him as funny is the big question, though.
Funny? No. intense, very aware, very lively. But yeah, no, he was preoccupied with his own concerns, I would say. And fascinating to deal with in that he was just so different to normal people. But he wasn't charming in the way he wasn't at that time. He was an out and out chess player. He was the world champion. He was fending off everyone else. He was trying to keep ahead of the pack. He wasn't the politician that he is now. Nowadays he's probably more amenable to others and more accessible. At that time he was a little bit different. So his priority wasn't to be liked. It was to be feared and to stay ahead of everyone else. And he did that. I mean, the guy's amazing. 20 years at the top of the world ranking list. 20 years. And that is just phenomenal. I mean, you just, in no other sport, I think, has anyone done that, as far as I know. And it's a phenomenally long time to be number one. And the mindset that kept him at the top. He was ruthless and tough and hard and, you know, tough as old nails. I mean, to stay that good and that motivated for that long, I think we have to take our hats off to him. I mean, was he the best of all time? Possibly. I think the only real contender for that spot with him would be perhaps Fischer, but I think Kasparov was probably stronger. And Magnus Carlsen, since that time, has shown that he's also very much a contender for the GOAT position, the greatest of all time. So clearly Carlsen hasn't done it for as long as Kasparov, but he's shown he's on that kind of level, and he's already been on that level for some years. So I think Carlsen is, the only player who can really compete with Kasparov for the, arguably for Fischer too, for this greatest of all time position as we stand at this point in time. Of course, the future may bring on another one. We've got a World Championship match coming, when is it, in November, is that right?
So what do you think, As a gambler, how do you assess Carlsen's odds?
Yeah, I think Carlsen is a strong favorite. Nipoman is talented. He's creative. He's a little bit inconsistent. He has good and bad patches. If he finds his form, it'll be an interesting contest, because he has got a good track record against Carlsen. He's one of the few to have a good track record against Carlsen. So it is possible that it will be a close match if Nipo is on the top of his game. But you've got to favour Carlsen. He's, as I've just said, he's probably the greatest of all time, and along with Kasparov. And the two of the same generation, they're about the same age, I believe. And I personally think it's unlikely that Carlsen will lose to somebody of his generation. I think the only person that's going to take the title of Carlsen will be somebody much younger than him in a few years' time. So I would heavily favour Carlsen overall. But as I say, it's possible that Nipo will put up a real fight. I wouldn't bet on Nipo unless the odds were 3-1 or maybe 4-1, then I might be interested in a small bet, but I wouldn't bet too much on it. I think Carlsen is definitely justifiably the favorite, and I'd expect Nipo to take the odd game off Carlsen, if he takes more than one game off Carlsen, it will be a very interesting match. But if not, I think Carlsen will probably win two or three or four games and win reasonably comfortably.
Wow.
Maybe 3-1 or something like that with a few draws. That's okay. What I would expect. But yeah, it's sport. Anything can happen.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, yeah, Carlson's priced at something like 75%, and, you know, seems reasonable to me.
I agree. Certainly.
So, and that means he can lose. All right. Well, Jonathan, it has been a real pleasure. So listeners, wherever you are, can grab the Kindle version of Contemplating Comedy. And I definitely echo Jonathan's endorsement of Secrets of Spectacular Chess as well. You are on Twitter. How else can people reach you if they're inclined, if there is another way?
Yeah, they're welcome to Twitter, to message me on Twitter or on Facebook. I'm reasonably open to friending people on Facebook. If they want to friend me, I'll probably say yes, unless they're very strange. You can email me directly as well through. Should I be giving my email?
I'll just put it in the description. No one's gonna write it down. So,
if
you're open to that, I'll put all the links for where people can find you.
Yeah, I mean, I do sign copies of my book directly by post for people if they're particularly wanting one. Although generally I'm not too keen to do that all the time. It's a bit time consuming to get popped to the post office and whatnot. But so if people can get it through Amazon or WH Smith or wherever they get it from, or the London Chess and Bridge Shop, I think, has got copies of my books. So yeah, I prefer it if people buy them the normal way. But yeah, you're welcome to email me if you want a signed copy for any or inscribed copy or anything like that. Anyway, Ben, it's been really lovely chatting to you, and it's, as I say, an honor to be on your podcast. It's a really fine series of podcasts you've done over the years, and I look forward to, well, hearing my own one with you shortly and hearing other people in due course.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jonathan. The pleasure's been all mine. Take care.
Bye for now.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible, most of all to my producer, Matthew Passy. I also would like to thank everyone who helped spread the word about the show. Did you guys know that there's still people who have not heard of the Perpetual Chess podcast? There's even chess players who have not heard of the Perpetual Chess podcast. So we need to fix that. And the ways to do that include writing positive reviews on podcast platforms or YouTube comments, telling friends. All that stuff makes a difference in helping spread the word about the show. But of course, I most of all want to thank people who provide financial support to the show. Without you all, Perpetual Chess would not be possible. So without further ado, I would like to give thanks to the following people and entities. Chessable.com, David Lazarus of LazmanChess.com, coach of Dave's Young Tigers on Lee Chess, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, Adapta Interactive Web Designs and Services, Apprentice Twitch Channel, Aniti Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, Chessmood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel Heath, Danny Davidson, David Mitchell, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Eric Tam, Farhan Thawar, Barasawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, I am Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, James Holyhead, James Kennedy, Jay Garrison, Jeff Martinson, Jeff Schaefer, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John MacArthur, Kevin Forsyth, Kevin O'Callaghan, King Cell, the King's Crusher YouTube channel, Lucio Casada Silva, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Can, FM Michael Oblin, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the famous Mr. Dodgy, the Nerdnaze Twitch channel, Grandmaster Peter Prohaska, Peter Sodi, Philip Flummins, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Reuven Fisher, Ross Crossland, Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Steven Martinez, Sven Gearson, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryan of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, The Vintage Patzers, which is a Chess.com improver group, Wayne Beam, William Hogarth, and I also would like to thank Ace Viega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovitz, Antonio Cancino, Antonio K. Leonfort, FM Andre Terekov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard, Lynn, Brian, Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Chad Hilton, Chess Patzer Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Kiefer, Chris Wayne Scott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Blaskoczek, David Brown, David Hamblin, David Cramley, Dalen Shelton, Tennis Parrish, FM Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Edwin Rodriguez, Ethan Smith, Evan Rosenberg, Ewan Richardson, Ian Mason, Felipe Melo Paria, Fox Valley Chess Club of Aurora, Illinois, Francis Letart Lavoir, Dr. Frank Tortoris, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Gene Stewart, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Han Shu, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Behan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Perry, James Aspinwall, James Benastio, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jadeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse Takumos, Jesse McNulty, Jim Ratliff, Joe Dasano, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John McAdams, John Tully, Juan Almagar, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, WGM Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kare Christensen, WGM Katarina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kevin Pryor, I am Kostya Kubutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Ryforth, Laura Boyovsky, Macaulay Peterson, Maria Emelyanovas, aka Photochess, Mark Shaves, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Bulatovich, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, the Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Gobel, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Negma Malajanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller-Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Cassie Passanen, Paul Blaine, Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited of Switzerland, Randall Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hallenbach, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Tichy, Robert Turner, Rory Coleman, Rory Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel and publishing empire, Scott McKinnon, Scott Rose, Sean Krause, Sebastian Finsterwalder, Sergey McCagan, Seth Ruzica, Sean Tracy, Silver Knights Enrichment, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatev Abrahamian, Thomas Brown, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tobiah Rex, Tom Edsel, Tommy Farron, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Vishnu Srikumar, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks to you all for the support, and we will catch you all next week.
Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.